This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 28th of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we ask what the French intervention in Mali means for the popularity ratings of François Hollande.
All the scenes we've seen these last couple of days are exactly what the French people and certainly the French government would like to see: jubilation in places that have been taken, and the front pages in, of course, the French language in Mali, reading things like Vive la France and praising François Hollande.
And we'll be assessing the prospects of the long-awaited elections in Zimbabwe.
Mugabe could still have another two terms. Given the fact that he is almost 89 years old, it's unlikely that he would live to serve another two terms, but the possibility exists.
Plus, we'll head to Paperworld in Frankfurt to find out why there's still fun to be had between the sheets.
If ever you want to show your product to a broader audience, you have to participate in Frankfurt on Paperworld. The only possibility to really know if the product is good is a participation on a trade show.
All that, plus music too, all to come in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Paul Osborne.
French troops have entered the city of Timbuktu as the operation against militants in Mali continues. They met no resistance as they headed for the city after earlier regaining the nearby airport. The French President François Hollande has said the joint operation with Malian forces is winning this battle. But the group Human Rights Watch has claimed Malian troops are killing civilians in a settling of scores as towns are reclaimed from rebels. Philippe Belopion is from the group.
The risk right now, as Gao, Timbuktu are being retaken, is that some people will want to take justice into their own hands, and that the Malian military might try to pick up some people and maybe kill them on the spot.
The first funerals have been held for victims of the fire at a nightclub in the Brazilian city of Santa Maria. 231 people died in the fire on Saturday night. Today, police have arrested three people, including an owner of the nightclub and a member of a band performing at the time the fire started. Egypt's main opposition group is rejecting a call for national dialogue made by the president. Mohamed Morsi was speaking as violence in the country continued for a fifth day. He's declared a state of emergency in three cities where a nighttime curfew is being imposed. One man was shot dead earlier near Tahrir Square in Cairo. State television in Iran claims the country's space program has made a major advance.
The country has successfully sent a capsule containing a monkey into space. The animal was sent into space on board a domestically built rocket. The indigenously designed and developed capsule was codenamed Pishgam, meaning a pioneer.
Officials say the creature was successfully retrieved. The Iran space program has been criticized in the past by the US and Israel, who claim it could be used to deliver long-range missiles. Opposition leaders in Syria have said they need actions and not only words from the international community. A conference in Paris has been discussing support for the uprising against Bashar al-Assad's regime. Representatives of the US government's International Aid Agency have been to a refugee camp in Jordan, populated by thousands of people who fled Syria. Ann Richard is America's Assistant Secretary of State for Refugees.
The crisis continues to grow. The numbers continue to grow. And so in order to respond, it's not enough to have done what we've done already. We have to do more. But we need more donors at the table. We need more countries to join with us and make major, significant contributions.
Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands is making a televised address in which it's reported she'll announce that she's abdicating. The Queen is approaching her 75th birthday. Reports from the Netherlands say she'll step down in favour of her son, Prince Willem-Alexander. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's 18.04 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We start the show today in Mali. The historic city of Timbuktu appears set to return to government control thanks to the decisive involvement of French troops who are surrounding it after seizing the airport from rebels. So far then, so good for France and for the president, François Hollande. But as Hollande managed through a much more aggressive and decisive show in Africa to put some of his domestic travails behind him too. Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson talked to Tom Edwards earlier and began by describing how the French mission's success on the ground is playing at home.
Yes, it certainly seems to be the case that Opération Serval, as we call it here, it's named after a desert cat, I understand, is going very well indeed. Today, we understand that the airport of Timbuktu and other areas surrounding that fabled town are indeed now back in the hands of the Malian people rather than in extremist hands. France has got close to 3,000 troops on the ground now. They're backed up by a very slightly smaller African contingent, mainly from Mali and from neighbouring Chad. But certainly all the scenes we've seen these last couple of days are exactly what the French people and certainly the French government would like to see: jubilation in places that have been taken. On Saturday, we had the news that the town of Gao, or the city, I should say, of Gao has been retaken. And the front pages in, of course, the French language in Mali, reading things like Vive la France and praising François Hollande, are exactly what people back here in France want to be seeing.
And I just wondered then on that point, what's the attitude towards François Hollande back at home? I mean, is the support completely overwhelming for him domestically, or are there still some elements there, political elements, who perhaps a lot slightly more cautious about this whole undertaking?
There are some elements that have been cautious from the outset here in France, but I think they are very much in a minority for the time being. The far left leader, for example, Mélenchon, his name is, he's been critical from the outset, as I think you'd expect him to be given his track record in opposing violence under all circumstances. But certainly with all the dire headlines that we saw a couple of weeks ago, there seems to have been an about turn in terms of how the French are viewing François Hollande and France's intervention in Mali, because the question was being asked, you know, of course, doing nothing was not an option at all for Mr. Hollande. He couldn't leave the Taliban effectively or an offshoot of Al-Qaeda to their own devices on Europe's doorstep. And so suddenly this decisive action, which took a lot of us in the media in France by surprise, just an announcement on a Friday, 17 or 18 days ago, that France was going to war with these extremist elements was extremely surprising. But the majority of French people support Mr. Hollande. The three quarters of French people polled in a recent opinion poll gave Mr. Hollande their backing. Now, this is very significant because until now, Mr. Hollande had been seen as this sort of compulsive ditherer, and the economy was in dire straits, lots of things going horribly wrong in France. It seemed like everything that Mr. Hollande tried to do was a catastrophe. But this last couple of weeks, I would certainly say there's been a very strong show of support for Mr. Hollande. And it's not just coming from France. I mean, even overseas, there seems to be a degree of respect for Mr. Hollande's decision. There's a nice piece in the New Zealand Herald, which I read last week, an editorial, and it says, in public relations terms, the balding, myopic 58-year-old muscled up quicker than Popeye swallowing a tin of spinach. So even abroad, there seems to be quite a transformed impression of just who Mr. Hollande is.
And then on that front, Tom, plainly this is working out well for him on PR terms, this particular engagement. Do you think that he'll be able to carry some momentum from that then into his domestic political theatre? Because obviously we were talking a few months ago, he was the least popular president ever, according to some polls. It seemed like he was almost hamstrung before he'd really got to grips with the role. Do you think he's going to be able to carry this momentum forwards, or is this really more a case of people being galvanised by this specific issue?
Well, certainly the hope in the camp of President Hollande will be that this will carry on. Just to remind you, it was only a fortnight ago that an IFOP opinion poll had Mr. Hollande down at 37% approval rating, making him really the laughing stock, down, you know, even 4 points on some of the low opinion polls we saw in December. So certainly lots of hope, and certainly the media making lots of mileage out of this campaign in Mali. Even Le Canard Enchaîné, which is a satirical Punch equivalent equivalent newspaper here in France, is now picturing Mr. Hollande in full battle dress and someone who's very much the supreme commander of the French forces in that capacity, taking his reputation into new territory. But he has had this reputation until now of being someone who sort of improvises as he goes along. But many saying this could be a real turning point. Maybe people hadn't been giving Mr. Hollande a fair enough chance. And certainly his language these last few days has got much, much tougher. At the very beginning of the campaign in Mali, he talked about limited action to hold the line against the Islamist rebels, he said. And then just a couple of days ago, he was talking about destroying all the terrorists. So he seems to have got on something of a roll here. But certainly there's plenty of issues back here in France that are haunting him. And perhaps the one thing that will make public opinion here in France really shift is if there's, as it's feared, there could be some sort of a reprisal attack on French territory for France's involvement in that campaign in Mali. And to a certain extent, we've seen evidence of that in Algeria, just across the Mediterranean from France, and a former French colony as well, where, of course, there was that holdup at the gas plant, killing lots of foreign people in Mali, and France's involvement in it was cited as a reason. So anything like that on French soil, and I think that could possibly turn the tide back against Mr. Hollande, and suddenly this French involvement in Mali could look like a lot less appealing prospect for France.
And just finally, Tom, I wanted to ask you then about what Hollande does next. We've seen this more bellicose rhetoric from him, which is obviously impressing some of his former critics, particularly in the media. Do you think that he'll be able to continue that sort of rhetoric, this more aggressive style, when it comes to tackling the domestic issues that he has to face, namely, well, the economy, as with so many other leaders in the West and elsewhere? There's obviously political, it's quite a divisive issue over gay marriage currently in France. Do you think he'll be able to be more aggressive tackling those issues as well, or will we see him reverting more to type A before?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the issue of gay marriage, or mariage pour tous, as the bill is called here in France. That was an issue that had something close to 500,000 people protesting against it just at the foot of the Eiffel Tower 2 weekends ago. This weekend, there were 125,000 people out on the streets in favour of mariage pour tous, so a fairly significantly lower number than were against it. Not surprisingly, some might say, given that it's, as campaigners say, it's easier to motivate people against something that it is for something. But on that very subject, Mr. Hollande has been extremely steadfast. He said there's absolutely no wavering, even when he had 500,000 people the very same weekend. So it was on the Friday that France declared it was getting involved in Mali, and it was on the Sunday that we had 500,000 people at the foot of the Eiffel Tower protesting against one of his key pillars of reform in France, that marriage bill. And he said absolutely no wavering. That's going ahead. And that debate has started now in Parliament. This week is the week when that debate gets under discussion in Parliament, and it could become law as soon as June. So on that very topic, Mr. Hollande has again shown he's not going to be blown. He's not going to waver at all. So it is impressive. He has, though, had to make rather embarrassing climb downs on other issues, such as that proposed 75% top tax rate. And there are issues in France that seem to be quite beyond his control, like the runaway unemployment level here. It's at its highest level in a lot more than a decade, at more than 10%. There's a stalled economy. And just on Friday, more dire jobless figures were published. That seems to be something that's quite beyond his control. But the things that are within his control, like this campaign in Mali, which was his decision, and like championing the mariage pour tous bill in the parliament, it does seem that Mr. Hollande has a certain degree of backbone that perhaps a lot of people hadn't given him credit for, perhaps as recently as 2.5 weeks ago.
Well, that was our Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson explaining to Tom Edwards exactly what the French press and people have been making of their president's foray into Mali. Coming up, we'll be off to Egypt to hear how the state of emergency declared by President Morsi over the weekend is working or not. Stay tuned.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we find out about the merits of urban beekeeping in Berlin. We visit an area of Seoul that has shaken its criminal reputation to become a hotspot for international restaurants. And we talk about a new trend, which has people pairing their hot dogs with a glass of champagne.
Champagne goes very well with fatty food because the acidity of champagne cuts through the fat content and it's extremely satisfying.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, a little over 24 months after the revolt that spelt the end for Hosni Mubarak, unrest continues in Egypt. The latest violence is a result of the death sentences handed out last week in the trials of those involved in a fatal football riot, as well as the ongoing dissatisfaction with President Mohamed Morsi. Not only has violence returned to the streets of the capital, Cairo, but a state of emergency declared over the weekend remains in force in Port Said, Suez and Ismailia. Monocle's regular contributor in Cairo, Rebecca Collard, has been out in the city to gauge the mood.
In this march, we are supporting our people in Tahrir, Bursaid, Ismailia and Suez. Because after Morsi has started the martial law, we are against this. This was exactly what Mubarak used to do. So what's news now? So we are marching right to the Shura against this speech he had yesterday.
This is outrageous. This is absurd. I mean, a part of his campaign was him saying that the emergency law is never going to be applied in Egypt anymore. And then he has this disgusting speech yesterday and he says that he is applying it in three governorates. So this is outrageous. It's unaccepted. He is trying to scare us and make us back down, and that's not going to happen. And what happened is, as soon as the speech ended, the rage in the streets in different governorates just increased. So.
Go on back. That's it. The problem after a few hours is finished, all everybody's back again to the home.
Okay.
Or the police catch him. That's good. If he's catch him, the police catch him, it's very good. Yeah.
Well, that was our report from Rebecca Collard out on the streets of Cairo earlier on. And Rebecca joins me on the line now. Rebecca, could you just tell us, what is the mood in the city tonight?
As the sun's setting tonight, it is getting increasingly tense and increasingly violent. Just up the corniche towards Tahrir Square, where I'm actually staying, a large march just passed. You heard some of the people that I spoke to there. They're angry. They're angry that they feel that Morsi has gone against his word. He has implemented the emergency law. He has done all these things that were done under Mubarak, and he said he wouldn't do. So people are getting angry. I'm seeing seeing reports now that they have managed to commandeer a security truck and that another one is on fire. So it's definitely getting increasingly tense here in Cairo.
And Rebecca, can you just unpick this latest situation for us a little bit? You know, we saw the trial come to an end of these people who were involved in the fatal football riot, where many people died. But is the rioting linked to that judgment, or is it really more about Morsi's response to it?
I think it's more about Morsi's response to it, especially here in Cairo. People were angry about the judgment, yes, but more about his reaction that he has so quickly put the emergency law into effect that for many people in Cairo and these other towns that are actually under the emergency law, this is him going against his word that he is doing the same thing Mubarak did, that there is no that their revolution is, you know, has not brought them anything better, and that they are still living under dictatorship. But of course, the last gentleman speaking in that recording there, he's actually saying he wants these people to be arrested, and I think it's important to keep in mind as going forward that, well, most of the people, the protesters, are obviously people that are taking to the streets, are very angry with Morsi. Some people are just getting fed up, and they just wanted to stop. We're talking about 2 years now of this sort of unrest in Egypt, and people are definitely getting tired and want some stability in the country.
Well, we saw this with the issue over the constitution a few weeks ago. Egypt seems to be a society that's really divided down the centre in a very brutal way. Is this just more evidence of that actually Morsi is trying to govern a country where he literally has like half the people behind him and half the people opposed to him?
I mean, I think it's even hard to divide it in two, because you have these separate groups. Of course, you have people that are supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were likely supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood when the Muslim Brotherhood was a very strong opposition movement in Egypt, despite the fact that it was illegal, of course. So you have these people that will support Morsi and his Freedom and Justice Party, which is essentially the Muslim Brotherhood, no matter what. But then you could say you have two other groups, one being these revolutionaries, these kind of activists, these people that are taking to the streets all the time, these people that are protesting, that are protesting against Morsi now. But you also have and who also protested against Mubarak. So who have been there kind of since the beginning for 2 years, protesting, demanding change in the country. But you have a third group, and I mean, obviously it's not this simple 1, 2, 3, but a third group. Of people who were supporters of Mubarak, who people often refer to in Arabic as Fulul, which means that they are remnants of the old regime and they supported the old regime. And now you can find them in Tahrir Square with these revolutionaries, because they are also protesting the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's very complex and definitely not necessarily divided, but definitely split. Egypt is now split among different groups who really want different things.
And Rebecca, just quickly, can you tell us what do you think we should make of Morsi the man? He, you know, when he first came to power, I think people thought he might be a slightly quietly spoken, kind of almost, you know, kind of a diligent man doing his job. But he seems to be quite strident and quite willing to, you know, see dissent. Do we think that he, you know, what do you make of his character out of this?
Well, you know, a lot of people that I spoke to in the last few days have essentially said that they don't really feel this is even Morsi, that he is basically controlled by the Freedom and Justice Party and the Muslim Brotherhood. So these are not necessarily his strong moves and his decisions, but maybe more kind of that he is kind of tied to these organizations. So definitely we're seeing strong moves, the implementation of the emergency law, etc. But I don't know if this is necessarily about his character or perhaps more about the kind of desperation by these organizations to continue to rule Egypt, which is obviously, we've seen in the last several years, very difficult task. 85 million people, lots of different political will, and lots of different issues here.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm sure we'll be joining you again soon. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now we head to Zimbabwe. The country's current constitution was drawn up in 1979 at the end of a 15-year war of independence. Robert Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party have spent the last 33 years in power, sharing a government of national unity with Morgan Tsvangirai and the Movement for Democratic Change since the flawed elections of 2009. Since then, the two parties have been attempting to forge a new constitution before fresh elections can take place. A condition laid down in the unity agreement between ZANU-PF and the MDC, a draft agreement has finally been agreed, essentially setting the election process in motion. Monocle's Georgina Godwin, who is a Zimbabwean, joined our news editor Tom Edwards in the studio to discuss what these new developments mean for Mugabe and for the people of Zimbabwe.
A draft constitution was agreed, I think, on the 26th of this month, and it hasn't officially been released yet, but certainly the document is circulating freely and people are having a look at it and analysing it. And, of course, this is effectively the starting pistol on the whole election process for Zimbabwe. Once the constitution's been agreed, it then needs to go to Parliament. They need to discuss it. It's got to be passed by a two-thirds majority there. I think there's no doubt that it will be passed. All the parties, the three main political parties in Zimbabwe, are campaigning for a yes vote, and I'm quite sure that the population will say yes. People are so sick of this whole process. It's gone on for so long. They just want it to stop. So people will say yes. And then, of course, the election will come after the referendum.
And what's the kind of time frame normally then? Because we see these processes are quite complex at the best of times, aren't they, in Zimbabwe? What's the likelihood of the elections being, within the next 6 months? I mean, is that the kind of best guess at this stage?
Yeah, I think October is possibly a realistic time. Certainly they won't happen in March, which is when we first thought it might happen. Not only are there financial problems, I mean, it's hugely expensive, obviously, to put on not just an election, but also a referendum. But the voters' roll itself is in complete disarray. So that's going to have to be looked at. In the last election, there were so many dead voters and people who weren't able to register, so many problems. So all of that will need to be addressed, because I think Mugabe is very, very anxious that this is seen as a credible election.
Now, another thing that Mugabe will be intrigued by, and this is something I gather that this draft constitution addresses, is about terms of office, because there'd obviously been pressure to introduce limits on the presidential terms. But I gather that Mugabe could still be in office for some time, even after these things are introduced. Is that right?
Yeah. He's been in power for 33 years so far, and this new draft constitution says that the president cannot have more than two terms of office. But it's not retroactive. So basically, we're setting the clock right back to zero. Mugabe could still have another two terms. Given the fact that he is almost 89 years old, it's unlikely that he would live to serve another two terms, but the possibility exists.
Now, another thing that has been obviously very divisive and controversial is this issue about compensation for land seizures, these land reforms. I gather there's more information about that in this draft as well.
Yeah, that's something that Zimbabweans feel very, very strongly about on both sides of the debate. And one thing the constitution is very strong on is that the land reform will not be reversed in any way. So land that has been given to people will stay out with the land holders, as it were.
Who picks up the tab for this? Do people look again to Britain? I mean, it's Britain's liability, presumably, and is there facility to meet that obligation?
Well, I mean, Britain first, in the Lancaster House Constitution, which was formed in 1979, Britain said that it would compensate and that there was a fund of money for that. However, and that started to be paid. However, once it was found that there was massive corruption around that and that land was not going to people that needed it, that it was going to political cronies, that source of income revenue was absolutely shut down by Britain, who said, we're not giving you the money, obviously, if it's not going to be used in the right way. Well, the Constitution has kind of thrown that straight back and said, yep, you can have compensation, but it rests, the responsibility for it rests with the former colonial power.
And in terms then of the impact of that on, for example, agriculture, these, you know, parts of the economy that were really damaged, particularly things like, you know, obviously Zimbabwe's biggest export was tobacco, wasn't it, before these land seizures happened?
Yeah.
That market was destroyed. Do you think there's any prospect that this could actually really help to, you know, restore, revitalise the damaged sort of agriculture sector, or is it unlikely that any of these things will change much on the ground?
I don't think that anything really is going to change much on the ground. I mean, the thing about agriculture is that you need to be able to finance it. You've got to be able to buy the equipment or the seed or whatever it is. You can't borrow that money unless you've got some kind of security, i.e. ownership of the land. Well, if nobody owns the land except the government, no bank is going to lend you that money. So it's always going to be now small-scale agriculture, and that is barely enough to feed yourself, let alone the rest of the country. It's certainly not enough to start exporting or to grow big cash crops like tobacco.
Now, let's look ahead then to these putative elections. They could be in October, certainly later this year, we hope, if all of this constitution is approved and a yes vote, that sort of thing. What will these elections look like? How would you characterise them? I guess an idealist would say they'll be free and fair and open and they'll be very accountable. Are we likely to see anything resembling that?
I expect not. I mean, it would be wonderful, but I think that enshrining these things in the rule of law, writing them in the Constitution is easy, but for them actually to be implemented is a completely different thing. I have been there. I've witnessed Mugabe's people torturing people, making sure that they can't vote. They've killed people. It's been a terrible, terrible time for Zimbabweans who are very frightened about going into another election. Just by saying that the army and the police can't interfere doesn't mean that they won't. And of course, there are very high stakes for everybody involved. To stay in power is an income source. It's a source of great kudos. It's a source of great pride. Nobody wants to lose that. ZANU-PF certainly are not going to let go without a fight. And I think that the new constitution, an improvement as it is on the old constitution, certainly doesn't give us any guarantees whatsoever.
That was Georgina Godwin talking to Tom Edwards about the rather weak prospects for free and fair elections in Zimbabwe. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be exploring the world of paper and checking in with some of Monocle's editors who are on assignment. But before that, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
French troops have entered the city of Timbuktu as the operation against militants in Mali continues. They met no resistance as they headed towards the city. Earlier, they'd regained control of the nearby airport. The French president, François Hollande, has said the joint operation with Malian forces is winning this battle. The first funerals have been held for victims of the fire at a nightclub in the Brazilian city of Santa Maria. 231 people died in the fire on Saturday night. Police today arrested three people, among them the owner of the nightclub and a member of a band performing at the time the fire started. Egypt's main opposition group is rejecting a call for national dialogue made by the president. Mohamed Morsi was speaking as violence in the country continued for a fifth day. He's declared a state of emergency in three cities where a nighttime curfew will be imposed. Iran's state news agency says it has successfully launched a live monkey into space and recovered it intact. There's been no independent confirmation of the report, which said it happened in the last few days. And Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands has announced that she's abdicating in favour of her son, Prince Willem-Alexander. Queen is approaching her 75th birthday. In a televised address, she said she'd been considering the move for several years. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
You're back on Monocle 24 with Midori House, coming to you live from London. Now, we're turning over a new leaf because we're heading to Paperworld in Frankfurt, the world's biggest trade fair for the paper, stationery and office supplies sector. Monocle's Gillian Tobias was there this past weekend, and we'll be hearing from her in just a moment. But first, let's hear from Ruth Lorenz, who's the VP of the Frankfurt Messe, or Exhibition Centre. She talked to Gillian about the current state of the market.
It's been a very tough year. The prognosis for last year, for 2012, was up to 3%. And in the end, it ended up with minus 2%. So it was a huge difference between the expectations and what happened in reality. But in my discussions with some of the exhibitors today, they are very optimistic because the general situation, the economical situation in Germany is very well at the moment. And so they are quite optimistic for the year 2013.
And where do you think the opportunities lie?
Yeah, the opportunities in that sector is really to look at things which can be invented, not only to look at the product itself, but to create a whole scenery, a whole, let's say, situation surrounded by beautiful products and by useful products. Beautiful and useful is a very, very good combination, and I think there is the future.
This is a very international fair, without doubt, but one can't help but notice as one walks through the halls, made in Germany. handmade in Germany. What is Germany's position in this market, and how have they continued to be innovative and so successful?
Germany is a very, very important country for the writing instruments, for example. You know these big brands like Faber-Castell, like Staedtler, like Schwan-Stabilo, which are really famous, worldwide famous companies, and they are really able to maintain that situation over centuries. If you just imagine, Faber-Castell exists since many centuries. So it's the good quality of the product, I think, which is also one sign, one symbol of German production.
You see all the biggest brands in the world here. You also have a section that enable young startup companies to showcase their wares.
If ever you want to show your product to a broader audience, you have to participate in Frankfurt on Paperworld. This counts not only for the big brands, but also for, as you said, the young, trendy companies who try to get into the market, who try to test their products. The only possibility to really know if the product is good is a participation on a trade show.
The market is fiercely competitive, and when you're exhibiting surrounded by the biggest brands in the world, what kind of advice can you give to smaller companies to showcase their innovation, to showcase their point of difference?
To smaller companies, we always say, don't show your whole product range. Just make a choice, a very selective choice of what's new, of what's interesting, and what's trendy. This is the only way to get attraction. Because if your stand is full of products, nobody will notice the real thing. But if you have a pure and selective kind of presentation, this is very, very interesting for the retailers and also for the big, big buyers.
How do you notice companies responding to a paperless world? Everything's becoming more and more digital. How are companies adapting to that or not?
You know, since more than 10 years, everybody tells us the paper will disappear because we are living in a digital world, in a more and more digital world. The reality is that there has never been so much quantity of paper used than ever before in the year 2012. So I think, yes, we are living in a digital world, but on the other hand, we are using paper for many, many other reasons, for the personal contact, for example, for good friends to inform them about many things. Me, myself, I changed my habits as well because I'm not writing emails to my friends. I'm started to write greeting cards to my friends because it's much more personal.
Well, that was Ruth Lorenz talking to Gillian Tobias, who I'm delighted to say joins me in the studio now. Gillian, let's just set the scene. I've been to that Frankfurt Messe. I think it was for the bathroom and toilet fair, actually. And it's vast. I've never seen so many exhibition halls. So I presume this is a rather major event.
It's massive. But for me, it was wonderful because I was always the kind of child that loved getting my pencil case ready for school and loved colored pencils. And there are halls and halls full of painting equipment and school equipment and stationery for the offices, massive and divided very thematically, because at the end of the day, it's a very, very high stakes business. And so they've quite carefully curated each room because they really do feel they need to help support these businesses be competitive.
So although it's called Paperworld, it's kind of pens, staplers, pens, notebooks kind of world.
Absolutely.
And it's aimed at everybody from corporate to personal?
It is, but it is mostly business. So you're going to find retailers, you're going to find the producers there, the retailers, the wholesalers, small shops and large. You don't really find the general consumer having a potter there.
Now, we heard Ruth there saying that, in fact, which was an amazing fact, there's never been more paper used than in 2012 than any year before. It's not going away, even in this digital age. But did you find some of the people, yeah, having some response to the digital age, feeling that they needed to do something different in the market to succeed?
Well, I've never been to Paperworld before, but I was really struck how almost every stand, they'd have their beautiful tactile papers, but they would all also have digital accessories, you know, cases to put your iPads, to put your apps, pencils that when you turn them around, you could use to, you know, pop your writing on your tablet. So they couldn't deny it. No one can deny it. So they're having to create lines that acknowledge the fact that this is a huge section. If they don't wake up, they're going to be redundant. But then again, there are those that have that and then decide, okay, we're going to embrace also our point of difference, the fact that people might want to slow down. They might not always want to be on screens. And so they're doing beautiful, beautiful fountain pens and beautiful ink pots. And they're communicating this with marketing as if this is the only pure way to express yourself. So they have both, but they're making very clear the difference.
And what other trends stood out for you?
Well, it was interesting to walk by. Similar, I've covered the fashion industry before, and there, of course, it's on what colors, what hemlines. And similarly, I was surprised to find that the stationery and pen world do it as well. So, I mean, they have a whole area where they really almost tell you what they're going to be to help the retailers. So there was, you know, an urbanism, definitely urbanism was in, and, you know, taking inspiration from Bauhaus and constructivism.
And just tell me finally, I know that in the publishing world and in lots of other parts of these sectors where they try and reinvent themselves, it's actually the premium market that does very well when you make something very good that's very exceptional. Is that the same for paper world?
Absolutely. And the premium market is very bespoke, customized, using craft is at the heart of it. They talk about the craftsmen who make the pens, materials of wood casing and leather casing. So absolutely. And it wasn't just sort of made in Germany. It was handmade in Germany. So the craft was really important there.
Well, I presume that your desk is groaning under a lot of notebooks and nice pieces of stationery. I shall come and check it out later on. Gillian Tobias, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this when we'll be finding out exactly where our foreign editor is.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here is 18:42 in London. Now, we're going back to Germany, and we're going to find out where our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is. Hello, Steve. Where are you?
Hello, Andrew. I'm currently in sort of halfway between Frankfurt and Leipzig on a train. So if the signal goes, that's why.
And tell us why you're doing this rail journey.
Well, it's quite a long rail journey. It started in Munich. I've gone via Stuttgart, Frankfurt, now on the way to Leipzig, and then tomorrow to Berlin. And the idea is to get a little bit of feel for how the country has changed. It's for our March issue, which is themed looking at what is modern Germany.
I must say, you're on a very quiet train. There's no train rattling effects at all. Tell us, you know, just in itself, Deutsche Bahn is a bit of a kind of metaphor for modern Germany. It's efficient, it's well connected. Are you finding a story to be told just about the service you're getting around the country?
Frankly, yeah. I mean, it's clean, it's on time, there's good food, there's coffee, there's people who come around and ask you if you want coffee. It's a good service, and it's incredibly well used by everyone. There's two very interesting stations as well that we've gone through. One, Stuttgart, which is a really bad station, but there's a big political story about the new station that they're trying to build there, which has caused enormous protests. But it's all about how they're trying to modernize that. And then the one I've just left, Frankfurt, which is your archetypal, beautiful, traditional station with the sort of the steel and glass sort of arch over the whole thing, which sort of shows the sort of the future of Germany, and then Stuttgart, sort of the trouble of trying to make it a little bit more modern.
Now, obviously, we're doing this story because we're doing a whole issue that's going to reflect on the nature of modern Germany and, more importantly, what kind of Germans feel about themselves and what their role in the world should be these days. You know, obviously, with the money they're pouring in via the EU to Greece and everything, they seem to have a big writ. But Germans often seem very uncomfortable about their place in the world. I know you haven't completed your journey yet, Steve, but what's your feeling about who the modern Germans are?
Well, I think you've hit it right there. There's this issue of, how much of a leadership role Germany really wants to take, how much of a leadership role the rest of the world wants Germany to take. And everyone's kind of tiptoeing a little bit around this. And I think, what we're most likely to say is that it's about time everyone really embraced it and accepted the fact that, this country's changed and that it's and that someone needs to take on this role, and they're the best place to do it.
And tell me, have you been to the eastern side of Germany before? I've never been to Leipzig. I imagine that's going to be an interesting chance to check up on how much the east of the country has caught up with the west since unification all those years ago.
Well, exactly. No, I've never been to Leipzig, so it's going to be a first time. So I'm quite excited to see how different it is from the other parts where I've been over the sort of the previous 24 hours. So I'm in Leipzig tomorrow and then Berlin tomorrow evening. I can check in then. One other thing just to mention as well is let's not pretend everything here is more lovely. In the taxi from the airport into Munich, I did hear What Is Love by Hathaway. I'm afraid the music hasn't perhaps come kicking and screaming into the 21st century just yet.
And have you had a chance to have a bratwurst yet?
I've had a lot of pretzels. Bratwurst is to come tonight. I will tell you what that was like tomorrow. But, it's got to be traditional German food all the way.
Yeah, some cheesy chips. I think they go well with the bratwurst. That's what I'd go for. Steve, thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you back in the next day or so, because you've got quite a lot of copy to write, actually, before Friday.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, right. I'll be back sooner.
Okay, nice to speak to you, Steve. That was our Steve Bloomfield, the man with the railway pass. He doesn't get to go on planes these days. We sent him to Germany instead. So look out, next month we're doing a big special issue about modern Germany and its position in the world. And I think it will be intriguing because even the Germans we've spoken to have been a little bit kind of cautious about taking on a bigger international role. But anyway, stay with us because there's plenty more coming up. Act, keeping the railway theme and keeping on a straight track for a little while, we're going to have a train-themed song. It's even called Train. This is Train, and it's by Sibella. And that was Train by Sibella. Now, you're listening to Midori House with Andrew Tuck, and we're going to cross over to New York, where every Monday we speak to our America's Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Aisha, thank you for coming on the show. We're going to look at the world of publishing first and the relaunch of the New Republic magazine. Can you just tell us a little bit of background to this, please?
Indeed. So I've got a new copy in my hands right now. It came out today, The New Republic, which has been around obviously for a very long time, bi-weekly, every 2 weeks, twice a month, quite left-leaning political magazine. And it's been relaunched by this guy called Chris Hughes, who a lot of people know of. He was one of the founders of Facebook and ran Obama's online kind of presence in 2008. And so he's a young guy who bought The New Republic and has tried to turn it around. This is the first edition of what we're going to see. A lot of people are talking about it. It's quite interesting. His first editor's letter, you kind of think of him as coming from this online generation. He would be doing a lot of hashtags and, you know, ads and talking a lot about social media, but instead he's invested in print. And what he says is, we believe that our new hyper-information age is thrilling, but not entirely satisfying. So it seems that he's trying to offer something which is a little bit more satisfying than social media.
Yeah, he seems a very interesting character. He talks about the fact that he doesn't believe in only short-form journalism and kind of tweeting. He believes in pieces that take a long time to craft. And I thought one of the funniest comments was, he was like actually opposed to people working late at night. He felt that people should kind of work a regular hours and go home kind of at 6 o'clock.
Indeed, it's going to be an interesting thing to see who's the reader of this magazine. So you look through it, and the advertising is very much kind of academic. It's Cambridge University Press. It's a bunch of universities. There's not a lot of advertising in this first issue. So I don't know who they're aiming for in terms of the advertising. But the people who are reading it, I think what they're trying to do is get the people who are reading Slate, who are reading a lot of online news, to buy this every couple of weeks, to subscribe. He's obviously done a very intelligent subscription model. So it's one price, which gets you online. It also gives you this thing which he's developed called cross-device syncing, which sounds a little bit foreign, but apparently all it is that if you're reading something on your iPad or on your computer, you go straight to it no matter which device you're reading it on. And another thing which is quite interesting is that he's done for every article an audio version, so people can listen to it as they go along. And obviously that's kind of a new thing. You know, we obviously have Monocle 24, but I don't know how many other magazines are doing that kind of, understanding that their readers want to listen as well.
But is that the idea? Literally, there's a 3,000-word piece, you'll hear it read by the writer as well.
Indeed. And so I'm not sure if it's read by the writer. I think they will obviously just hire a voice. I don't think the writer's committed to reading out their piece. But it does mean that you'll have people, you know, driving or on a run or whatever, digesting it in that way. And online, the website itself, there's a lot more kind of interactive feature. You can click on things, you can tweet at people, but the magazine itself feels quite smart. It doesn't feel that it's going to alienate the older readers. There's still long form articles. This first issue, there's articles, there's an infographic on military drugs, the drugs that the military are on. There's a big Obama profile, which is the cover story, which isn't surprising seeing as Chris Hughes was involved with Obama. That's a good way to get the first edition off the shelves. There's a photojournal essay on Syria rebel fighters. So it's kind of quite obvious things, but he says he's moving away from politics and going towards covering things like Homeland or girls TV shows, so not to be too precious.
Well, I was going to say, you know, he says that they're going to not be politically aligned, and you can certainly tell that from the front page of the website. When I go to look at the most their latest stories, there's a piece about a new show that's Downton Abbey for grown-ups. There's a piece about Beyonce. There's a piece about a Tampa socialite. So they're doing quite a few pieces going almost the realm of Vanity Fair, it feels like.
Indeed, and there's an Ai Weiwei profile, which obviously we've all read in New Yorker or New York Magazine, all sorts of magazines over the last couple of months. Everyone's talking about Ai Weiwei, but there's a piece on him too. I think that if you've got Obama on the front cover, and we know that Chris Hughes was working for him, and we know that it's not going to be particularly the most sympathetic to the GOP, but I don't think anyone would expect that from the New Republic. But I think they are trying to at least introduce readers who possibly will want to read about people as opposed to issues.
The only funny thing about the cover is, don't you think, that it has a picture of President Obama, and it's the cover line is, "The president is not pleased," but he looks really happy.
He does look really happy, and in all the photos through the rest of the actual profile piece, he looks pretty happy. And the cover, he has a little bit of a smirk. It does reference covers that we've seen of Newsweek, and I think it's important to discuss the New Republic in the context of Newsweek folding, people trying to do something interesting there, Tina Brown, and that didn't work. So I think a lot of people are waiting to see how well this goes. Chris Hughes has a lot of money behind him. A lot of people are skeptical as to whether he's trying to turn this into a viable business or if this is kind of a vanity project for him. But if the New Republic succeeds when Newsweek failed, it'll be interesting to see.
And where do you think they'll make their money? Because as you said, there's not a huge amount of advertising online or in the magazine. And their own figures say that they sell 1,700 copies across America on newsstand.
I think they're going to try and push for greater advertising. I mean, really, there are so few ads in this magazine that there's so much space for advertisers to get involved. I think that they've got Monsanto, the food group, involved, and that's pretty much it apart from academic advertising.
Well, Aisha, that was a good New York check-in, even if we did only talk about one subject. Thank you very much for joining us. That was Aisha Spears, who's from our Monocle Bureau in New York. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Tom Edwards, and our researcher, Fernando Agosa Pacheco, and also our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next off the news is this week's episode of Culture with Robert Bound. This week, they welcome Devendra Barnhart to Midori House for a chat and a song or two. So stay around for that, because that's a bit of an exclusive, I think. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Gillian Tobias, you heard her earlier, she's coming back, she's not going anywhere, will be back for the Monocle Daily. And then after that, Tom Edwards will be here tomorrow with Midori House at the same time. So stick around for that. But for now, goodbye.